Hej och välkomna till Udda Ting, en podcast om sällsamma historier, kreativitet och kreatörerna själva. Mitt namn är Henrik Möller, musiken var skapad av Testbild och loggan till podden är gjord av Malmökonstnären Nalechinsky. Det här avsnittet ska handla om skräckförfattaren Michael Shea, och jag har tidigare gjort ett avsnitt där författarkollegor som Laird Barron och dataspelsförfattaren Mark Laidlaw berättar om honom. Men nu, efter Guillermo del Toros Netflix-serie Cabinet of Curiosities, som gjorde ett avsnitt baserat på hans kanske mest kända novell The Autopsy, så kände jag att det var dags att göra ett nytt avsnitt. Och vem är då inte mer insatt i detta än hans änka, Linda Shea? Varsågoda. Is there any anecdote about how you found these stories, or when you found out that this guy that you were dating wrote those amazing scary stories?
Oh my God. Oh yeah, there is. I was working in a hologram factory, probably only hologram factory in the world at the time. But one of the guys who worked at Multiplex had hung out or gone to school in the Berkeley area, I think at Raymond. Michael had done his undergraduate work at Berkeley, Cal Berkeley. And they met back then. So Michael had just come up from Los Angeles, and he was recently divorced or in the process of a divorce. And I don't know if you read Mama Dirt. Have you read Mama Dirt? Mr. Cannyharm. I've got the name wrong. Did you read that one? If you want to know about that period of time, that novel is set in that period of time in San Francisco when I met Michael. And so the protagonist, Jack Hall, there are similarities to what Michael is doing. Years later, Mr. Cannyharm had not been published, and I asked Michael about it. I said, I really liked that book. And he said, you really liked it? I said, yeah, I liked it. And he said, but Jack, the protagonist, is such an asshole. You know, so that's like the much older Michael looking back at the younger character that he'd written, like, oh my God, if I did it again, he'd be a much better guy, you know, that kind of thing. But when I met him through this guy named Peter, who is a holographer also, Peter Claudius, and Michael came to see him at the Multiplex company. And I remember very vividly, I had an office loft. And I look down, and here is this unbelievably, amazingly handsome big guy with a red sweatshirt and tortoiseshell horn-rimmed glasses. And I looked at him, and I was a goner. That was it. I mean, that's what it... And the first gift he gave me when we first met, he showed up the next day with a couple little things that he'd put aside for me. And one of the things was The Autopsy in FNSF. And he told me it had just been published. And so I read it. I thought it was amazing. A common friend of ours, after we had started going out, said to me, Linda, did you read that story? And I said, yes. He said, how can you go out with that guy? You know? But the deal is, everything in Michael's horror was never slasher horror. It was always metaphysical horror. And there's no way that question isn't there constantly in every moment of our life, you know, of our lives, the metaphysical side of it, that the moment we're born, we start dying, you know, and the incredible loss of the beauty of what we're seeing to ourselves individually. So that's how I felt about his work. I recognized right away that it wasn't just stupid horror, you know, that it had this amazing metaphorical element. And then after that, I think I read Angel of Death, which also, you know, just had so much humor and social commentary. So that was how. I mean, it was beautiful, and it was, I'd had some background in reading and appreciating horror and science fiction, because you're not so much science fiction, but more fantasy and horror, because, you know, I'd read all the Ballantine books, the Lord Dunsany, all that kind of stuff. So and even Ballard, you know, futuristic horror. So I already knew about the contemporary wave, talking about our century, the tradition of that.
Do you have any favorite of Michael's stories?
Yeah, I got to say, I think the Grolem is on the top of my list. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful and harrowing. And because it took place in Sonoma County, I actually drive by the dilapidated shed that appears in that story. Still there, kind of falling apart. And of course, I love much of the Lovecraftian stuff, personally. You know, like the girls in the hotel, Miss, you know, Fat Face. I love Fat Face. I've always loved Fat Face. There's and strangely enough, in the one that I mentioned by mistake, Mama Dirt, which was published also by Hippocampus posthumously, there is a monster in that story. His name is Lazarian, and I guess after Lazarus, kind of, who is a mafia hitman, but he's also a samurai. And he has the face of a cherub, and I think Michael refers to him, to the horripilations on as his hair rises and the things that he experiences. He remains maybe my favorite character. I love Lazarian. He's just so phenomenal to me, to my sensibilities. And he's not well known at all, I don't think.
Are you talking about Mama Dirt, that story that's in the Joshi collection, Demiurge?
It has a short story, but this is the novel. And the novel came first. And it's kind of my fault that the short story came out at all. Michael wouldn't have done that. But we needed money. And, you know, two kids going to college, high school, and ST was looking for a story and Michael had it. And I said, why don't you just do it? He goes, but I said, oh, come on. He said, sure. So that was how that came to be a novella.
Probably one of my favorites of Michael's Lovecraft stories is Tsathoggwa. Could you talk a little bit about that story?
It's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. I love the portrayal of the woman with her dog. And I like the woman who, the straight woman who disses her on the street, you know, as she's pushing her little dog in the shopping cart. That was actually based on another friend. See, Michael always took people he met in the real world and kind of incorporated them into his stories. So she, Maureen is actually based on someone we knew, who was homeless for a long time, who had a little dog she carried with her everywhere, you know, and who was very stubborn and strong-willed. And so I think Tsathoggwa is hilarious. I love it. And I like I seem to remember that there are scenes where the slime plays a large part. What is it that you like about it so much?
One of the most original ideas in that story is the idea about the dark miracle, that instead of passing out or going insane like Lovecraft's characters, they are converted by witnessing this dark miracle.
I think that runs through most of Michael's work. That's one of the big themes. I mean, if you look at Copping Squid, I mean, talk about the dark miracle, right? You know. So, yeah. I think that is definitely a resounding theme, because it's all a miracle. I think he regarded it all as a miracle, every moment of it. That I think, you know, parasitism runs through his stories, because he was fascinated and frightened by it, I think, on a certain level. I think spiders scared him a little bit, but they also absolutely fascinated him. He imagined, like, oh my God, what if they were really big, you know? And he got to work that out in the Tor books, the extra, where it was the giant mechanical spiders. So I think the mechanicity of it in the service of life, you know, he regarded as a complete miracle. I think its architecture It's beauty. He was particularly fond of jumping spiders, the little guys with all the eyes that could jump. Are you familiar with those? Yes. And who loved the orb spinners. But I mean, he used, on our country property here, there were all kinds of bugs and creatures and stuff. And he would be out there digging in the dirt or doing something, and he would find something and bring it in and show it to the kids on the palm of his hand. And he was analyzing it, you know, see its exquisitely shaped thorax. See, this is how it does it. It was all a wonder to him. You know, he's the only person I ever know who, when I cooked fish, took out a microscope and looked at the scales.
Do you know what inspired him?
Well, if you look at his reading, you know, his own literary tastes, to be quite honest, he didn't read much science fiction. He read Gibbon constantly. He read Caesar. He read Shakespeare nonstop. There were contemporary writers that he respected and he loved their work. But if you looked at what he himself was reading, it was history. It was Cormac McCarthy. It was people that he considered to be just amazing. He read a lot of Harold Bloom. And so he was very, very tied to the classics and to history. I think that was the research for many of his stories and his sensibility and his sense of poetry and verse. He had studied Greek grammar. He had taught himself a bunch of Gaelic. You know, he was a classicist. And yet he loved Evelyn Waugh. He loved to laugh. So any turn of phrase that was truly brilliant, plus the traditions, he was fascinated by it. So I think that's the basis of much of the NIFT work, and also that sense of relativity about, you know, our place in the universe, our place in the world, and the hero, you know, the importance of the hero. So that was his research, really. I think if there was something he was interested in, when he became near the end of his writing time, he became kind of fascinated with the Arctic and did a bunch of Lovecraftian stories set in the Arctic. And so he was reading about and researching the Arctic. But I think it was mainly historical. And then when he did, there's another book that's coming out called Apricot Brandy. And Hippocampus is also doing that one. That's going to come out, I think, this year. That's based in Northern California. It did come out originally under a pseudonym. It's a long story, but it came out under a pseudonym. And I felt that it should come out under Michael's name. So it's going to come out again. And that one is based in Northern California, like I said, but it has a strong indigenous tradition, because there's a grandmother in it who is an old Mexican woman with tons of tradition and reference to the Mayan gods and magic and witchcraft. And so he did some research into some of the Mayan panoply, the pantheon, but it didn't take much to set him off. You know, he wasn't somebody who spent a ton of time in research. He read about it, he got ideas, and then he went for it.
Laird Barron said that one day Michael just got the idea to write Lovecraftian mythos-inspired short stories. Do you remember anything about this period in time when that happened?
Well, he did Colorado Time first. So that was a product of like being in, he hitchhiked to Alaska when he was 18. And he had been a serious writer since, you know, doing poetry and short stories. He read Lovecraft up there for the first time. And he thought to himself, I can do this. And then he also read Vance after that. And he thought, I can do this. And so I think he regarded the genres, but the smaller subsets of the genre, like mythos and Vancian tradition. I think he regarded it as a tennis court with specific boundaries implied in the mythos. And that on some level, that it was easier to play in that world. It was a defined world that as a young writer, he felt that, yeah, I can do that.
He wrote a few stories set in the Antarctica. Do you know what his fascination with Antarctica was?
I mean, who isn't fascinated by the mountains up there? But I think it was kind of the idea of a last frontier that fascinated him. You know, he'd grown up in California. His dad had ridden the rails as a young man during the Depression. It was a different world. It was, you know, California was an open, free space in so many more ways than it's still big and spread out and wonderful and you get lost in it. But there was no internet. There was no cell phones, as we all know. As a kid, you know, there are some stories that I can't remember what they're in, but they're in one of the collections that came out posthumously. One of them is called the Baldwin Hills. It's kids taking off on their bikes into the Baldwin Hills. That's around Los Angeles. That's something he grew up doing. And so that whole Western ethic of open space and real world, you know, although he was a city, he loved the city, but he was very much tied to that. It was part of his background. And so I think that Alaska represented just this giant, mythic, untrammeled space, you know, with the unknown, you know, inside the glaciers, under the water, just all of it. I mean, who knows what's in there, right? So how could it not? It attracted him near the end of his life.
Another of his original ideas was to present the consequence of that dark miracle and the connection to the great old ones as something like a drug addiction.
I mean, I think, you know, as a young man, he had his own experiences with drugs. Not that he was a drug addict or anything like that, but he used them, you know, as part of the generation for sure. And knowing that it was him, I don't think he ever did it. That was always part of his subset, always part of his thought that that's what he was looking for. Right? You know, the mythic experience, the he used to call it wig bubbling, you know, just sitting there and thinking things, that the inspiration, the thought, you know. So I think it would have been an experiential connection for sure.
What also impressed me about these stories is that they are sometimes very pulpy and larger than life, but there's always a serious tone in there that make them work in a way that most other Lovecraftian fan fiction don't. In a strange way, they feel kind of personal.
Being with Michael was a little bit like that. He was, I don't know if you met him, I don't think so, but he, in some ways, he was larger than life in a quiet kind of way. And once he knew you and he started talking to you, then there would be these cascades of metaphors and language around you that you were surrounded with just for the pure pleasure of it, right? But he was, you know, pretty amazing to be around. One story that I think of that illustrates it for me is when we were in the California beaches, there was a gray whale with her cub or pup, whatever they call her, calf. And they were maybe a couple hundred feet from shore. They were swimming out there. And we were there with our kids. Our kids were little. And Michael just jumped in and swam out to be next to them. And they weren't afraid of him. Another time we were at the beach and there were balloons from a cruise ship way out on the horizon. And he swam all the way out there. I got him and brought him back to the kids. You know, he wouldn't think of anything. He wasn't super cautious about things, you know, like that. I know that he'd had the experience that he was sitting on a rock, you know, talking about drug-induced experiences. This was in college, and he was sitting at Berkeley, and he was sitting on a rock up at the beaches in Northern California, north of San Francisco, just looking at the waves, and he and his friends were tripping. You know, it was the 60s. They were tripping, and a giant wave grabbed him off the rock, and all of a sudden, he's out in the middle of the ocean. You know, things like that happen to him more than other people, I think. He had that side. So his writing reflected, you know, really a part of his person.
Again, comparing his protagonists to Lovecraft's, they are not academics, but working class guys, like underclass and homeless people even. That also feels kind of unique to that genre.
Well, you know, he was a strong guy. He was a big guy, and he was determined to be a writer when he was in college. He graduated magna cum laude from Berkeley, and he was offered jobs, you know, a teacher's assistant and stuff like that. He had just sold his first book. So he goes, nah, I don't want any of those jobs. I'm just going to be a writer. And he pretty much stuck to that for a huge amount of his life. Except he did teach ESL for many, many years in many, many schools, and that's English as a second language. So he got to see a huge component of people coming to this country from God knows where, from everywhere, from Russia, from China, from Mexico, from everywhere, people struggling to get a foothold and make it. And he himself, you know, once put an ad in the newspaper which said Earth Mover. This is when the kids were little, and he was trying to make money. And the earth mover was him with a shovel. He painted houses. He did not go the super professional route because his only job was to write. So he had that blue collar component in his day to day, picking up construction, picking up jobs here and there. Only later did he go back for another master's and teach even more.
Which of his Lovecraft-inspired works are your favorites?
Those three that we talked about, Fat Face, Copping Squid, Zathagua, those are very much probably my favorite ones. I also like this little one called Degoniad, because it the crazy character ranting in the streets of San Francisco. His character comes back to me pretty frequently. I do like the latter, the Beardmore stories also. I'm fond of those. There's one that wasn't published that I'm also very fond of. It's a novel. I don't know if it's in good enough shape for it to be published. I mean, the man wrote all the friggin' time, but it was called The Plunderers. it's the idea of, like in Fat Face, the Shoggoths wear human bodysuits, you know, that hold all their blubbery stuff together. The plunderers in this one run a funeral home or operate out of a funeral home.
Maybe we should go into the Cabinet of Curiosity adaptation of The Autopsy right now. I heard it was a long road to get there, since it's considered such a classic. Del Toro was not the first one to option it, am I right?
Well, originally, Ted Browning had bought that story maybe 15, 20 years ago for a series for TV. He had actually paid whole lot more than Netflix paid for it. And the story was made, pretty much made, and then the series was canceled. So it never aired. Over the years, there were countless people who were interested in turning The Autopsy into something, a film, you know, or whatever. And somehow or another, it just never happened. Then Michael passed away, and Michael definitely was not one to promote any of his work. He didn't bother. And I was approached by Netflix. They wanted to do it. And supposedly Del Toro had read the story himself and had specified it. I was hesitant to do it because I thought, well, this was kind of like a one shot that somebody was going to make it into something. And if I sold them that, it might not become a movie. It might not become this. It might not become that. But at the same time, I needed a new roof on my log cabin. And I wanted to see it get exposure. I thought the exposure would be good for its own sake. So I sold it to them. And I had a little bit of trepidations because I thought, oh my God, they're going to mess it up. It's going to be horrible. This is a mistake. Am I going to get away with this? You know, I felt bad that I'd done it. I wasn't sure. But as it turned out, I think they did a pretty good job. I think Murray Abraham was good, a good selection as the doctor. And the guy who played the sheriff was also very good. They stuck very, very tightly to the story itself, which I'm glad they did. They actually even lifted some of the dialogue right out of the story. I'm not so sure that I was really thrilled with, there was something in the scenes with Joe Allen when he confronts the doctor that somehow didn't quite sit right with me. I'm not sure what they were, but since I can't articulate them, I won't go on about that. But I thought in general, they did a pretty good job. I think it served the purpose of making more people familiar with Michael and his work because it didn't just say Netflix, it said Story by Michael Che. That was primarily what I wanted, besides to fix my roof. You know, so
it's interesting the way that story changed.
It was so funny. When Michael first wrote it, this is what he told me, he sent it in to Ed Furman. And I think at the end of the story, who was the editor of FNSF, way back then, you know, the famous Ed Furman. And Ed wrote back. And Michael wasn't known at all, except for, I guess, Symbilis at that time, and maybe Colorado Time. But I mean, he certainly wasn't as well known. I think he'd been nominated for Angel of Death for World Fantasy Award. That's a novella, but he certainly wasn't that well known. And Ed Furman wrote back and said, "I love the story, but I think that the ending is a little too depressing because in the end he dies, I believe." And Michael said, "Oh, okay." And he rewrote it so that the doctor took his own life in order to trap the monster. So that was like an in progress and is one of the strongest parts of the story, I think. And it gratitude to Ed Furman to pointing out that it needed something at the end that was different. And, you know, you had asked about how he wrote things because he was such a visual person. I think he saw scenes in his head or he saw that type of thing. And then he would start with that. He didn't outline anything, never outlined any of the stories. In his notebooks, he would scratch out scenes of what he thought. And that's how the story would evolve. There was a time there where he was literally driving about maybe 200 miles a day, teaching at three different schools. And he would come back and write at night, talk about how driven the man was. And he would write on the seat of his truck while he was driving. And there was these sprawling, looked like abstract expressionist art, but actually it was his handwriting as he's writing out these things that are going through his head. And I think that they were scenes. And I think that when the Grolim, when he thought of the Grolim, maybe about a month or so after he thought of it or whenever it was, he said something to me. He said, "I had a really good idea, I think." And I said, "Oh." And I said, "Why?" He said, "It scared me."
At one point, he was editing something, and
we sometimes in the morning, only after we've been together for like 25 years or something, 30 years, we would read stuff in the morning of his just because it was fun. That was done, that had already gone through maybe two or three drafts, right? And it was on its third draft, and he was finally ready to have it read. And so I would read it to him out loud a little bit so he could hear it and make comments, often pretty stupid comments, I think, of my own. But he said, no, anything you say is okay because it's your impression of how you're taking it, right? But that was when he would show it to somebody. I think he had a little bit of that, the Irish superstition that if you, or the artist superstition, you can dilute its intensity if you talk about it too soon. You don't talk about it until it has a life of its own, until it's, because you dilute the juju, you dilute the, you know, the intimacy with it. So he would just go back there. I would hear the typewriter years ago, like the sound of rain and lots of laughter. Later, I would hear the computer. You know, just a worker in the vineyard kind of thing. Yeah, no, he didn't do any of that. He didn't talk to people about his stuff. Didn't research that much. He would just go and do it.
Have I forgotten anything, or maybe something that you would like to add?
If he knew that any of his listeners wanted to write, or that he had inspired anybody to write, or that people got what he used to call a good read from his work, that was what he wanted. He wanted them to be entertained and to have that enjoyment. And he'd call it a good read. And if they were thinking about writing and they wanted to do it, he would, people who would ask about it, he would say, just do it. Don't worry about it. Just do it. It's yours. No, you know, no one can say anything to you. Just do it. That was his freedom and his ownership in the world, right? So I hope that people will see and, you know, appreciate his work and get the humor. There's tons of humor in it, and get a feeling for who he was. Because his work is very much as though he was talking to you. He actually spoke like that sometimes, you know, so I'm gratified that people are reading his work. I'm gratified that there's all these new readers that are reading his work. I feel like his voice is still very much being heard, and I'm glad for that.
Yes. So thank you, Henry, for doing this and exposing it to more readers.
Ja, och med de orden så var det slut för den här gången. Mitt namn var Henrik Möller. Musiken var skapad av Testbild. Hej då.